What is power? We can offer a solid starting point for the investigation of power by combining definitions provided by Stephen Lukes, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Daniel Wildcat. Lukes draws directly upon Spinoza, while Nietzsche does so indirectly. Wildcat offers an indigenous perspective on power, which seems to extend more broadly than that of Lukes and to get around certain fundamental limitations typical of the Western tradition. Following Aristotle and Spinoza, Lukes distinguishes between two meanings of power, potentia and potestas, where the latter, potestas, is a subset or type of the former, potentia. He translates these terms as power to, potentia, and power over, potestas, such that power over is a variety of the power to do something or other. Potestas, or power over, is a capacity to constrain the actions of others. Lukes writes that the concept of asymmetric power, or power as potestas, or power over, is a subconcept or version of the concept of power as potentia. It is the ability to have another or others in your power by constraining their choices, thereby securing their compliance. We often think of power as meaning nothing but power over, which can also be called domination. But if we reflect that the capacity of an individual or group to do one thing or another, for example, to understand and reform a certain system or technology, is also a power, we should recognize that domination, while important and extensive, does not exhaust what is meant by power. Most broadly, on this view, power means the capacity of someone or of some collectivity to do something. Thus, a person with a certain education has the ability to read, while a person lacking it is not able to engage in this activity. At this broadest level, power is not defined by domination, though, of course, the capacity to dominate others and the earth does exist as well, and it is an important question who has such a capacity and who lacks it or is subjected to it. Broadly, power, potentia, means the capacity to do. Thus, in Aristotle's philosophy, a good life is one in which key human potentialities are developed. That is, a good life is one in which our capacity to act is broadened as far as possible. And Agamben refers to a life of power in which the form of one's capacities and consequent actions are objects of attention and action. Nevertheless, it is true that mostly when we talk about the question of power, sociopolitically, we are referring to domination or potestas. It is a fact that in innumerable ways our actions and the actions of others, both human and beyond, are formed in one degree or another by external forces. Others have power over us. Political theorists therefore often ask when and how such power over is legitimate, if ever. What are the processes of the establishment of relations of power over? How power over can be altered or inverted, and so on. These are important questions, but they take for granted what is meant by power. They assume that power means power over or domination, and are therefore peripheral to the investigation of what power is in itself. In fact, by taking power as exclusively power over, they tend to occlude the broader reality of power, which is power to. It is important to keep this broader horizon in view because when we engage in intentional action so as to reorganize relations of power, we are concerned that individuals and groups have the capacity to develop themselves and their abilities, and not only that who dominates whom gets reshuffled. Though in a society saturated with the domination, we often confuse empowerment with movement into a position where we are able to dominate others, becoming powerful extends beyond becoming dominant and can even require the neutralization of dominations. There is a certain line of thinking within the materialist tradition which focuses on domination, identifying its existence throughout the social fabric, and detailing its mechanisms and its transformations in time. The most famous analysts of domination in this line are probably Machiavelli and Nietzsche, both of whom produced scandals by seeing domination and power, in this limited sense, where conservatives wished to name only nature. Both theorists seem to have favored pyramidal social forms, in which a few dominate many, and yet in producing analyses of the functioning of such forms, they also provided tools to those who wished to intervene in and alter systems of domination. Nietzsche followed Spinoza in viewing the world as a single system of power, but it may be that more than Spinoza, he tended to reduce power to domination. Both thinkers tended to see the world as nothing but a complex relation of forces, where the form of each thing, each being, separated out analytically from the complexes in which they are enmeshed, is determined by other things and processes. In Spinoza, each mode is determined by the action of other modes in their vicinity, and in the large picture, by the composite action of all modes, all beings, together. Thus, the very shape of beings and of their actions is determined from without. But then, on the other hand, for Spinoza, a certain force of persistence, the conatus, is essential for each of these modes or beings. While each mode receives its form from without and is thus subject to powers from without, each also constitutes its own force and acts upon the others, such that the form and capacities of each being actually results from the overall struggle between wills. Nietzsche continued this line of thinking, writing, "This world, force throughout, play of forces and waves of forces, this world is the will to power and nothing besides. And you yourselves are also this will to power and nothing besides." There is something disturbing about the claim that all there is in the world is force and relations of force, compelling and being compelled. And yet there is also something liberating about that notion, insofar as it might free us up to begin an examination of the empirical relations acting on us here and now, so as to begin to alter them. At any rate, Nietzsche seems to have reduced power to domination, and when expanding Spinoza, he suggests that each being ultimately wants not only to persevere in its being, but also to expand its power. He means that each being essentially wishes to dominate, and he thus posits domination as the whole of power and as the essence of reality. Here also, there is something disturbing, since, as in Spinoza, goodness and evil are denied any reality, and the world and ourselves are presented as nothing but impulses to dominate. But again, there is also something liberating, since what is left of our interest seems to be reduced to strategic considerations about how to become more powerful and dominating, and to be less dominated by others. These analyses urge us either to shut up or to get on with the struggle. Now, Lukes noted that power in the largest sense, as potentia, or capacity to, may be said of, to use the technical Aristotelian language, either individuals or of collectivities. We speak of agents having powers to do certain things like read or ice skate or to dominate others. While Lukes' view is coherent and clear, we should also note that it stops at this level. Lukes does not ask how the rooting of agents in certain contexts relates to their capacities. He does not look beyond the agent or conceive the agent as an emergent product as opposed to a basic fundamental element. The question is only who has what capacity. The who may be individual or collective. It may be a certain person, or it may be states, institutions, associations, alliances, social movements, groups, clubs, and so on. Though his view is limited, Luke's does offer us something useful. While the capacities of individuals, per Aristotle, emerge from their training and education, as well as, perhaps, certain innate dispositions, with collectivities there is a further qualification. Luke's writes that collectivities typically have coordination problems, but where these do not exist or can be overcome so that the collectivity can act, then it too can be said to have power. That is, not just any collectivity has power, but only those collectivities which have been organized so as to enable the elements composing them to act in a coordinated fashion. Empowering collectivities in large measure thus means organizing them such that they can act as blocks. Western thinking on power seems to near its limit in a way that mirrors its language. Because we speak of individuals as the ones having powers, where the individual is a subject of which a certain predicate, in this case a capacity, may be posited, and even collectivities, like institutions, are conceived as individuated entities which can be named, and again, said to have certain capacities which are predicated of them, we are likely to stop short of conceiving power as something which extends beyond individuated agents, and even which constitutes them. Spinoza and Nietzsche, and following them, Foucault, move to consider individuals as functions within extensive systems. But the indigenous view, expressed in thinkers like Daniel Wildcat, may be clearer and more direct. Wildcat's definition of power emphasizes the periphery of the individual or the collective, such that the capacities of a given individual or collective, as also their personality and their other tendencies, are conceived as resulting from the ambience which surrounds them. Wildcat writes, "Power, the living energy that inhabits and or composes the universe, is what moves us as human beings. All of the connections or relations that form the immediate environment or that small part of the world each of us inhabits. Power is a qualitative dimension shaping our thoughts, desires, habits, actions, and institutions that operates to a great extent without us thinking about it. In ordinary language, we can call power amorphous, for it takes many forms, some overt and some latent. We are conscious of the former, while the latter lie dormant and have an existence to which we are not initially conscious. We can also describe power as diffuse, for it surrounds us as an atmosphere of influences, including the very practical economic influences in the world. Power is quite literally flowing around and into us. If we are properly attentive, power can be used by us." This is not a contradiction of the definitions offered above, so much as it is an expansion. To consider power, for Wildcat, is necessarily to consider how individuals or individuated collectivities fit into their contexts. To say that an individual has power, either in the broadest sense of potentia or the more limited sense of potestas, is to say that they are connected in certain ways to the material world they inhabit. As in Spinoza, the greater the connections, the greater the power, and the less the connections, the less the power. Being powerful is not ultimately a feature of an individual conceivable in isolated abstraction, but an index of the active engagement of that individual with real processes and forces environing them. These environing forces include, but are not limited to, networks of other actors, material resources and money, and flows of information. Since the material world consists also in energetic phenomena beyond the social and economic, including both the known and the unknown natural world, the power of individuals or of specific collectivities also emerge from natural engagements, both clearly understood and only intuited. On this view, to investigate power is to investigate the manner of rooting of an individual or a collectivity in the real material locality which surrounds them. In theoretical and academic contexts, we often pose as objective investigators, disinterested in the subject we are studying. This pose, however, is of limited value. Spinoza, Machiavelli, and Nietzsche are invigoratingly dangerous because they diagram situations in which we can never truly be disinterested, though we can certainly be disempowered. What is the point of understanding how our capacities are nurtured or inhibited, how our communities are empowered or disempowered, how we dominate or are dominated, if we are not also interested in maximizing our capacities and our power and reducing the degree of our own domination? If we are not interested in our own situation, if we remain neutral or objective about our own disempowerment, isn't this disinterest and neutrality itself a product of power? Isn't being disinterested and neutral very close to refusing our own empowerment? Who benefits when we deny ourselves? Who has made us like this? So, it seems the study of power must ultimately be a study of our own power or disempowerment for practical purposes. And this means also a study of our own contexts, not only contexts far removed from us. We must study in order to perceive and conceive how our abilities are grown or stunted, by whom, and for what purposes. We must study domination, not only in order to become dominators, but in order to understand how the form of our very capacities and actions, the form of our everyday lives, follows from the strategies of others who profit from them. And we should do this not objectively, but interestedly, with the intent of determining how to change things in our favor. Since empowerment or disempowerment result from different manners of being environed, being subjected to an atmosphere of influences, the most potent form of investigation, the one most likely to move us to a place where we can begin to act so as to transform ourselves and our communities into more powerful beings, will be the one which focuses here and now where we are. Power is quite literally flowing around and into us. If we are properly attentive, power can be used by us. We need to look at the power relations of which we are a part, the physical locations which we inhabit, and the collectivities in which we participate. Such interested study is academically heretical, but determinations of heresy versus orthodoxy are, of course, power relations. And does academia empower us or disempower us? What is its value to us strategically?